Jeffrey Lichtman for Beyond the Legal Limit. It's March 11th, and frankly, I'm sick and tired of talking about the news because it's just a never-ending cycle of garbage. If you saw the Joe Biden State of the Union, it was so depressing on so many different levels, and then you find out that his opponent is Donald Trump, and he just managed to get his idiot daughter-in-law to head the Republican National Committee. So we're going from one bad situation to the next. So I'm going to try to avoid, for the most part, talking about the news in this podcast. And, you know, look, we've also reached a point in the podcast where I'm running out of stories for my career. It's not that I'm perhaps necessarily running out, but I've forgotten probably many of them as well. So, you know, here we are. You're stuck with me, and this is what it is now. Some of the stories that I have extra, I can't say in the podcast. Some of the better stories, to be frank, because I just can't until certain people die. But, you know, it is what it is, again. Now, I know I did forget last week a story about Alex Chilton. I hope that you listened to Big Star. We put the wrong song on one of the Big Star songs that was on. It wasn't the acoustic demo version, but I'm assuming that you followed along and you figured it out on your own. The song Jesus Christ. That should have been the demo. I gave you the directions. Follow it. Listen to me. I'm right at least 50% of the time. Now, the Alex Chilton, who's the head of Big Star, the leader, I mentioned that there was a urinal story. Now, you know, a lot of people wrote to me and they want to know about the urinal story. It's not that good. It's not like some great story. I probably should have just thrown it in as an aside in the last podcast. But here we are. So I'm going to tell it to you quickly. My third year of law school at Duke, Alex Chilton was playing at like a dive bar music venue in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, called the Cat's Cradle. A real dump and certainly well beneath him, but we had heard that he was going to be there, so I went with my friend Elvis, also now a lawyer. Elvis, that's not his real name, but that's for another, that may have to be for another podcast, because as I said, I'm running out. And we went to go see Alex Chilton, and he was playing the songs and blah, 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 but it was very informal because it was a small venue. It was loud. And during the break in the set, I went to go take a leak and I look and there's Alex Chilton next to me taking a leak. Now, luckily, you know, back then, I mean, you know, when you're young, I was 24, I suppose. I mean, you could pee for like an hour. So it gave you a lot of opportunity if you wanted to speak to the guy next to you and hope that he doesn't take out a gun and shoot you. So I just, and it's typical of me, is I found myself next to a guy that I really idolized his music at that point. I was just really getting into it. And I remember I said something that was really an impressive line to say to a musician who's played every one of his top songs 14 million times. And I just looked at him while he was doing his business and said, "Hey man, can you play September Girls?" Which is like one of their best songs. And of course they're going to play September Girls. And of course they're going to play it for the encore at the end. And of course I didn't need to say that to him, but alas, that was all I managed to be able to squeak out. So he looked at me, and to his great credit, and this is an important lesson for life, he didn't just say, "You know what, go fuck yourself." He just looked and says, "Yeah, sure." And, you know, zipped up and walked away. Immediately I had, as typical of me, I had immediate remorse and regret because it was really dumb. Now, years later, I did have a better night with Lou Reed, as I described last week or last podcast. But alas, the Alex Chilton urinal story is a big letdown. So I've really got to pick it up from here if this podcast is going to keep any listeners. Now, I wanted to talk about music. I started listening to music when I was very young. I've always been a huge music fan and a big classic rock fan, although there were some fits and starts along the way. Because of the vast amount of information available on the internet today, I've been able to nail down some real dates of some of the things that I'm going to tell you, even though they occurred many decades ago. I can give you an actual date because there's just so much that's available on the internet that didn't exist. If you're not, you know, if you're under 30 years old, you have no idea what I'm talking about, but you couldn't get this stuff. You couldn't get information whenever you wanted. And so I can give you information, the exact dates of when I went to certain concerts. In addition, I'm a hoarder. Obviously, I'm a collector of baseball cards and other things, so I'm a hoarder. And I still have all the ticket stubs to all the shows that I pretty much ever went to, so I could confirm with those dates on those ticket stubs as well. June 25th, 1978, I had just turned 13 years old. My first concert ever, ever. It was at Giant Stadium, a football stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey, just a huge outdoor venue. Not a great place for a concert, as you can imagine, because you can't hear shit. There's 76,000 seats, plus all the seats on the interior, you know, on the field. So there's probably 80,000 seats. And of course, they weren't all filled. Why? Because the show was for Pablo Cruz. He was not the headliner. He was the third headliner. It's actually a band. They had a great song called Love Will Find a Way. It was a big hit for like, I don't know, 15 minutes in the mid-70s. The second, the runner-up, I suppose, the first runner-up, the under-headliner, was probably should have been the main headliner, was the Steve Miller Band. And Steve Miller, the great guitarist, had a zillion hits in the 70s. Huge, huge, huge. And the headliner was the Beach Boys. They were a hugely successful act in the mid to late 60s and then kind of fell off. They had Pet Sounds, which was an experimental, great album. But, you know, they're kind of happy, peppy California surfing music. Didn't really carry over into the late 60s, into the early to mid 70s with all the hard classic rock. But they had released a greatest hits album entitled Endless Summer and got them huge again, which is why they were headlining the Giant Stadium show. Steve Miller also was very big, as I said, and he had a greatest hits album that sold 15 million copies. It was huge, by far his biggest album, but you know, you should look at it. It's just incredibly poppy, hook-driven songs. I mean, Fly Like an Eagle, Jet Airliner, Jungle Love, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, Steve Miller was very big in his own right, and I think that album, his greatest hits album, is one of the greatest selling albums of all times. And I actually looked this up. It's the second highest greatest hits album in terms of sales after the Eagles' greatest hits. Now, around that time, I also went to see Boston, the band Boston, at Madison Square Garden on August 29th, 1978. It was just at the end of that same summer. I was still 13. I also saw ELO, Electric Light Orchestra, with Jeff Lynne at MSG, Madison Square Garden as well, in September of 1978. Now, at this time, punk rock and new wave music were becoming really big, but I was still stuck with classic rock pretty much at around that time. Elvis Costello, these are bands that were beloved by me later, but not at this time, even though they were already out. Elvis Costello, the Ramones, the Clash, Graham Parker, they had made their debuts by the time that I went to go see ELO at the Garden, but I really hadn't found them yet, I suppose, until I watched a certain Saturday Night Live episode on October 14th, 1978. Now, this is just the next month after I saw ELO. I'm seeing all these classic rock bands, and all of a sudden, I'm watching Saturday Night Live. You know, now Saturday Night Live is a joke. I mean, you have to be some kind of, you know, imbecile to actually watch it. But back then, it was just the best. It was edgy. It was funny. It was groundbreaking. You had, who was on that show? John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, Jane Curtin, Bill Murray was on it. Chevy Chase was on it at one point. Eddie Murphy at one point was on. Gilda Radner was on it as well. But it was not just a great comedy show, but it also had great music guests. Just the best. You'd see these fantastic musicians on this very small stage, and you'd watch it on TV. It was really just a magical thing, and it was like appointment TV back in the 70s. I watched it every Saturday night at 11:30 at night until 1 a.m. when it ended. From 11 to 11:30, right before it, was SCTV, Second City Television, another great comedy show. But again, SCTV was great, but Saturday Night Live was amazing in America. And then on October 14th, 1978, I was 13, the musical guest was a band called Devo. I can't describe their music. Industrial rock, punk, I don't know, new wave. It might have been like a novelty act because they were so goofy. They would come out wearing these yellow, what looked like to be vinyl hazmat suits. That's what it looked like. And they had in black Devo printed on them near their neck. Sometimes they would have these red cone hats. But anyway, the band Devo stood for de-evolution, which meant society going backwards instead of going forward. They were society was devolving instead of evolving. They had on these old, like those old 3D glasses that you'd get at the movies that were like, looked like they were cardboard and they were sort of square lenses and they were big. And they were doing these robotic movements, twitching, actually, it seemed like, in sync. It was totally bizarre when they came out and they introduced, you know, here's Devo. And they just started, it was crazy. You have to see it. Saturday Night Live, Devo, 1978. And they're playing this song called Satisfaction. I had never heard of it before. It was such an odd song. And then they came back later in the show and they played a second song called Jocko Homo. And I was totally hooked. A bizarre band, nerdy but catchy. And the next day, I bought the 8-track tape. Because that's what you did when you wanted to buy an album. If you didn't have a record player, or if you wanted to take it into your car or your parents' car, because I was only 13, you bought the 8-track tape. Now, music in my mind pretty much began. I was buying 45s, the small vinyl records and the long play, the LPs. But when I started getting into music heavily, it was with the 8-track tape. And the LPs, the vinyl, had a great sound, although if you had a dull needle and never, you know, always, if you're a kid, you always had a dull needle on your record player. And it was, like I said, it was unwieldy. You couldn't bring it anywhere. You couldn't drag these giant records around. They were like these like small pizza boxes. But the sound was pure, even with the crackles and the pops and the hisses from the record, because the needle was going around this endless groove and it would pick up every piece of dust and dirt would be in the grooves and hence the noises. But the 8-track tape was supposedly the next purported improvement, evolution from the LP, except it was not. And I have to seriously wonder about the intelligence of a society that could think that the 8-track tape was an improvement on anything. It was that bad. And it was like this, like I'm trying to explain it to people that have never seen one. It was like a plastic chunky rectangle with magnetic tape that ran across the opening, the mouth of it, the top of it. And it was good sized. The sound was horrible. It wasn't like a cassette. It was like maybe two or three times as thick as a cassette if you piled them on top of each other, and maybe two or three times as long if you put the cassettes on top of each other. The 8-track sounded horrible. And the most amazing thing is that there were only four tracks. There were four channels, excuse me, of music on an 8-track tape. I don't even know what 8-track stands for, what it means, because there were four channels. Channel 1, channel 2, channel 3, channel 4. Like an LP would have a side 1 and a side 2. A cassette would have side 1 and side 2. But the 8-track had four channels. And like a CD is continuous. There's just one. 8-track had four. And sometimes the music, the songs couldn't be broken up so that they would end before the channel would change. So you'd be like in the middle of a song and it would end in channel 2 and then start again on channel 3. I mean, this is real. It's hard to believe that this is real, but it's real. And when it would go from one channel to the next, it would make this heavy clicking sound. But before the music would, it wouldn't just change right in the middle of the song. It wouldn't just be the song click and then the song would continue. The music would fade out at the end of the part in the middle of the song, at the end of the first channel, and then it would slowly come back up in terms of volume, not too slowly, in the next channel. So you'd listen to some music of a song, it would fade out, there'd be a pause, you'd hear a heavy, loud clicking sound in your 8-track player, your stereo, and then the music would fade back in. And it just sucked. I mean, it completely just destroyed any kind of momentum that you had when you're listening to the song. It just broke up the song. And I can, this is a true story. I'm telling you, this is the truth. I can never hear Bruce Springsteen's song, She's the One, from the album Born to Run, without wincing at the point in the song where it would traditionally fade out on the 8-track tape and then click and then restart. I still hear it every time I listen to the song. We're talking, that album came out in 78. I think I bought it probably in 1980. We're talking 44 years later, and I still wince at that point in She's the One. Now, that first Devo album was released in July of 78, and it kind of changed my music tastes on a dime. They weren't even close to being my favorite band from that era, but they were my first favorite, I'll say. Now, I'm going to play you the first 39 seconds of Devo's Satisfaction from the first Devo album. The name of the album is Question, Are We Not Men? Answer, We Are Devo. That was the name of their fucking album. I mean, it's just completely bonkers, man. So here's the first 39 seconds of Satisfaction. Listen up. And it took me years of listening to this song before I finally realized my favorite song on the album. I listened to that song. I listened to obviously the whole album. I finally settled on a favorite song from the album. And I know this is going to come as a shock, but the name of the song, and again, I apologize profusely before saying it. I don't mean to offend. I never mean to offend. The song is called Mongoloid. And it's fantastic, and it's as politically incorrect as you can imagine. I played the entire song of Mongoloid on WABC Radio in New York City during one of my radio shows about 12 years ago or so. This is like the largest radio audience in the world. It was the leading radio station in the biggest city in the world with the most listenership. So the most people that could be listening in the world at that time were listening to me playing Mongoloid, and luckily I think the program director missed it. But the song is incredible, and to me it's like beyond the herky-jerky, weird Devo stuff. Here's the first, it's a lot of time I'm playing here, 93 seconds of the song Mongoloid. This is a song that you can almost dance to, I suppose. I don't, maybe not, but listen to Mongoloid, please. And again, with all my apologies, I know that it's not the politically correct word now, but first 93 seconds. Go ahead, Mr. Producer. Now, here's the thing. It was a different world in 1978. You could say politically incorrect things and you wouldn't get lynched. It was just a world where we had kids who were, what's the word I'm looking for here? I guess mentally disabled. I don't know what, I should have looked this up before I did the podcast. I don't know what the correct word is, and I apologize if I offend anyone, because I genuinely do. I've got great empathy for people, as anybody who knows me well surely knows. But we had kids that were in our class when we were 10 years old, 9 years old, third grade, fourth grade, who back then, this may be still be the correct word, I don't know, but back then they were called retarded, and they were in our classes with us, even though they clearly couldn't, you know, they couldn't be put into the same reading group, the math groups, and it just was a different world, man. This was public school in New Jersey. They should have put them in a class with professionals that could reach them and teach them, but they just didn't. They just threw them in with some 24-year-old student teacher and then some other teacher who was 100 years old. It was ridiculous. It was so completely unfair, but we had them in our class. And every year, I remember in third grade, we had two of them in our class. And I think sometimes they left to go to their own special instruction, but they were with us. I don't know if it was to socialize them. It really shouldn't, because we weren't comfortable. We didn't understand. It was very bizarre to us. I remember this. They couldn't even really speak. They were profoundly mentally disabled. Is that the correct word, Mr. Producer? Not retarded, but mentally disabled. And, you know, we used bad words in describing them because, you know, now they're bad, I guess. Anyway, I'm not going to go too much into it, but in third grade, we were making peanut brittle, the entire class. Everybody had a little, I don't remember how to make peanut brittle, man, so you're going to have to excuse me. I don't remember the recipe or what we did. I just remember we had a lot of peanuts that we had to crack, and we had to throw them into this big vat of goop, and then it got put into some oven. Then the peanut brittle came out. Okay, that's how it happened. I don't remember exactly. We're all getting ready to put our peanuts that we had shucked from the shells. You know, we cracked them out. And we were going to throw them into the, I think it was peanuts. I don't remember exactly. I think it was peanuts. Peanut brittle probably was. And I'm looking over it at the kid in the class who was mentally disabled, or back then it was called retarded. And he's got like his finger, this kid Timothy, his finger into his nose, like up to the elbow, I think pretty much. It was, you could just see like the back of his elbow. The rest of it was stuffed up his nose. And he's throwing his peanuts into the giant vat of peanuts and goop. And I'm like, fuck this. I'm like third grade maybe. I'm like, fuck this. I'm not eating any of that peanut brittle. I think I was the only one that saw it. I have to check with my friend, Dr. Crazy. Dr. Crazy was in that class. I should check with him when this podcast is over. Do you remember seeing Timothy with his finger just jammed all the way up his nose, almost like hitting his brain, then tossing his peanuts into the big vat? So, of course, when the peanut brittle was handed out the very next day, I did not partake at all. And look, this was weird. I mean, I think about it now. This could never happen in schools today. But like, you'd be walking around like the schools, like, you know, sometimes when you'd go to another classroom, you'd have to go in the stairwell, like at the end of the hallway. They didn't have the stairwells like in the middle, like it was like in a house. It was like at the very end, you'd have long hallways, and then you'd have like a little area you'd go in, and there were stairwells, and they were metal, and you'd walk up to the next floor or the next floor. And there wasn't elevators. We didn't have any elevators back then. Everything was two or three floors, so it wasn't that big of a deal. But sometimes you'd be in the stairwell, and there'd be like poop smeared all over the place on the walls. This is the shit that I grew up with. This was normal to us, and as I said, in school in New Jersey in the 80s, and we laughed about it then, and we're probably all going to go to hell for it, but that's how it was. Why did I tell this story? Because Devo had a song called Mongoloid and no one cared back then. Anyway, back to Devo's song Satisfaction. The great Vietnam War movie Apocalypse Now was released in August of 79, like 10 months after I saw Devo on Saturday Night Live. And Apocalypse Now was starring Marlon Brando, Martin Sheen. I think Robert Duvall was in it as well. And as I said, just a year earlier, I had heard Devo singing Satisfaction on Saturday Night Live. And the trailer for Apocalypse Now was all over the TV. And I was stunned by what I heard. The trailer, the song on the song track, it was for the trailer, was a Rolling Stones song, and it was the entire trailer, and it sounded eerily familiar, at least in terms of the lyrics, as Devo's Satisfaction. And all of a sudden, I realized, holy shit, the Rolling Stones did Satisfaction before Devo. That Devo song was a cover. And I'm going to play you the first 40 seconds of the Rolling Stones Satisfaction, and you can hear same lyrics, completely different song. Go ahead. Now, I was just 14 years old at the time, and I was listening to the major rock bands of the era. There was a group of three bands that were the very top. They were exalted when you were a kid. You said their names in hushed tones, okay, because they were the best. You had The Who, you had Zeppelin, and you had the Stones. They were like the best, and they were at differing stages of their output, I suppose, their productivity. And the Stones were sort of in a lull at this point, around this time. This is before Some Girls, and they had had some shitty albums. So I hadn't known any of the old music, which is why I didn't know Satisfaction, which had come out, I think, in like 1965. The other bands below the exalted three were like, as I said, ELO, Kansas, Yes. These are, you know, bands. ELO was still a great, I don't think the music has aged, but for God's sake, Yes certainly has. But anyway, I tried to understand how back then I could have missed the song Satisfaction, and it makes sense. It was in the 60s. I wasn't listening to it. I was really listening to music that had come out in the very late 60s into the 70s, into 1978 around the time. So I was really kind of shocked when I heard that Devo's song Satisfaction was actually the Rolling Stones. Now, in fairness to the Rolling Stones, as I said, Some Girls, which was their last great album, came out in 1978. That's the album with Miss You, Beast of Burden, Before They Make Me Run. There's some great, really great Stones song. But that was really their, that was the end of the Stones in my mind. And it was a completely different band than their 1965 version. And why am I telling you all this? The reason I'm telling you all this, and these I'm trying to fill up some space here, is that I want to get to my favorite Stones song. Now, I became a huge Rolling Stones fan as time went on, as an adult, really. But to me, their best albums were 1968 to 72. And as an adult, I've listened to this golden era of the Stones 100 times or more, literally each album. And I'm not a Mick Jagger fan. I'm going to be honest with you, and I'm going to tell you the reason why. And again, I don't want you to be offended. Please don't be offended. And you know what I'm going to tell you? I'll tell you. I never liked him because I felt that there was a diabolical, controlling way about him, but not in a fun, sadistic way. And I'm trying to be careful here. You want somebody who's in control of your band who's, you know, has a little bit of boyish sadism to him, I suppose. You don't want a guy like Mick Jagger who you could just see. I think he went to London School of Economics. He just seemed to be more about the money and the commercial aspect. It was a turnoff. You could tell it even as a kid. He just seemed too uptight. And then he wore spandex on stage. And it was gross. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. He would wear like these, it wasn't like a spandex shirt. It was like his chest was hanging. It was gross. It was fucking gross. I'm going to be honest with you. He looked like a goddamn fool running around, He was too skinny and with his spandex, and it just was gross. Now, I understand that spandex was a thing back then, but man, I didn't like it. He overdid it. And then what was the coup de grace for me with Mick Jagger was when he did that duet with David Bowie in that video, and the song was Dancing in the Streets, which is, you know, the original versions, I think, is Martha and the Vandellas. I'm guessing. I think I'm almost certain it was Martha and the Vandellas. And his version with David Bowie just sucked. It sucked so bad. And I beg of you to go on the internet, go on the interwebs and find Dancing in the Street, Bowie, Jagger. You will be vomiting in a bucket. All right? Bring a bucket with you. It's, and I'm going to say this gently without offending, because you know I'm a fan of the gays. I'm for gay marriage. I'm for all, pretty much, you know, all the rights except the weird ones that we've learned about the last few years. They were dressed so gay. It was hard for me to watch. Like beyond gay, like if, like gay times 16. And like a new level of gay is what I would say. And I didn't like it. I'm not homophobic at all. But it was, I think it's even too gay for the gays is what I would suggest. This is a tough podcast, but I digress. Just because Mick Jagger makes me puke doesn't mean I can't love some of his music. And I, you know, I'm just realizing this is going from bad to worse. I should just stop this podcast and maybe not do this one, because I listen to all the good Stone stuff. And by far, and listen, I'm right about this. I'm not right about everything. I'm not even right perhaps about most things, but I am right about a lot of music things. And the best Stones album, to me, by far, which means it should be to everyone, is Beggar's Banquet. And I have listened to this album a million times, and there is one song on the album, and it's a great album, my God. Listen to Beggar's Banquet. It's just phenomenal. There's just Stones classics, one after another. But the best song by far on the album, to me, is Stray Cat Blues. I'm going to give you a lot of too much. I'll probably get sued for this one, but I'm not making any money off this podcast. It's costing me money, but I want you to listen to the first minute and 42 seconds, 102 seconds of Stray Cat Blues. The lyrics to the song are so outrageously inappropriate today that it makes me sad in a way that we're past that era. I'm not suggesting that they were ever appropriate. Let me think how to say this. Back then, apparently it wasn't inappropriate. It was accepted. There was not any kind of big outrage over the lyrics to this song. I mean, kids grew up faster back then. It was a different world. But the reason I'm saying, I'm not suggesting I'm condoning what's said in the song, but the reason I'm saying is that you could actually say shit and not get canceled an hour later. There wasn't like Big Brother who told you what was right and what was wrong for you. I never really thought about the lyrics of Stray Cat Blues in the song, and I really don't today. I don't think the song could be played on the radio today. I'm sure it could not. I'm sure it could not. But the lascivious sounds coming from Mick Jagger at the beginning of the song are so comically appropriate for the song. I want you to listen to the song many times so you'll understand. But even the musicians out there that are listening, I beg of you, listen beyond the minute and 42 seconds that I'm about to play here. I want you to listen to it again. Listen to, it's just such a great song. Go ahead. Go ahead, Mr. Producer, play it. All right, then. We're going to take a break. I want you to ponder on what you've heard. I'm going to be back in a second. Jeffrey Lichtman for Beyond the Legal Limit. Hi, I'm back. I had to get all that Devo stuff out of my system, and I'm going to whipsaw you here and talk about something different. I watched the State of the Union, or I didn't really watch. I watched a piece of it, and I just found it to be so utterly bonkers. But to listen to Joe Biden talk about the Palestinians and how we have to save them, and it's so important to save them, and they can't be hungry, and they need aid, and Israel shouldn't use the promise of aid to manipulate them. You'd think that these are innocent, defenseless people, as opposed to anti-American, bloodthirsty, radical Islamist maniacs, which is what the polls show. 85% of the civilians in Gaza supported the October 7th massacre in Israel, and the same percentage support Hamas now, even after Hamas has gotten the Gaza Strip destroyed. But the concern about civilians is shocking to me, because when, 500,000, 600,000 civilians in Syria were being massacred by the butcher of Syria, Assad, I don't think there was a fucking peep out of Joe Biden. I don't think he said a word about them. He doesn't care about them. Why? Because there weren't a savage pro-terror voting bloc in a swing state as there is in Michigan today for the Palestinians. So suddenly he has to pretend that he's all concerned about civilians. But you know what word he never mentions is the word Hezbollah. That's the Iranian, another Iranian terror proxy, not Hamas in Gaza, but Hezbollah in Lebanon, which took over. They've killed hundreds of Americans in the early 80s, and they killed the prime minister of Lebanon on their way to hijacking and bankrupting the country. Lebanon used to be just a jewel of the Middle East, and now it's barely functioning. It's become taken over by Iran through Hezbollah. They've been firing rockets at Israel since October 7, killing a handful of Israelis, keeping 80,000 residents away from their homes now for over 5 months. We've discussed this. As I said, they're aligned with Hamas. They're controlled by Iran. And we keep hearing about how Israel needs to make sure no civilians in Gaza are harmed, even though, as I said, they support Hamas and the massacre. Why don't we ever hear Joe Biden or any other world leader demanding that Hezbollah stop firing rockets at the civilians in Israel? For some reason, they don't matter, I suppose. I don't really understand that at all. America has given the savages in Gaza $180 million, that's your money, in aid since October 7. They've killed 40 Americans. They hold a bunch hostage. And for some reason, they're allowed to do that. And you barely hear Joe Biden criticizing Hamas. He's only criticizing Israel. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And now we're hearing that he's going to build a port for Hamas in Gaza. That's just what they need, a port. Every bit of aid that came through Egypt, they were sneaking in weapons. And now we're going to give them a port. And I'm sure they're not going to do anything nefarious with that. So we're now at the point where we're feeding and we're assisting Hamas. Killed Americans, but it's okay because we need the votes of the Muslim terror bloc in Michigan. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. These are the people that celebrated on 9/11. They'd kill us any chance that they could get, and we're going to give them taxpayer money. You got to give them a port. You know it's going to be hijacked by Hamas like everything else has, all the trucks that went in. It wasn't Israel's fault that these savages, these zombies are throwing rocks and shooting and terrorizing the truck drivers. The Egyptian truck drivers don't want to come in and drop off aid anymore because they're tired of being attacked. They don't want to get killed. They know better, but for some reason, America thinks that Israel should continue feeding the enemy that massacred, raped, burned, and tortured them on October 7. In the real world, what should be happening is they go fucking starve until they surrender. That's what war is. You don't feed these animals. It's crazy. I don't understand. So why hasn't Hamas surrendered? Why haven't they given up yet? Because they know that they've got America in their corner. As I said, Biden needs the Muslim terror vote in Michigan. No sane Muslim actually cares about, who actually cares about Gaza, would want Joe Biden to stop Israel from ending Hamas. Because if you really care about Gaza, you don't want a Muslim terror group in charge, which has held Gaza back for since 2006, keeps them in the Stone Age, separates them from the world. Problem is that the average Gazan, the average Palestinian, doesn't give a fuck about being cut off or under Hamas's thumb. They love them. This is a radicalized people. They love jihad. They tell us, they keep telling us, we love death more than you love life. And these are fine people that I'd want to give aid money to. As I said, the polls show that they're the most anti-Semitic people in all the Middle East, which says a lot because it's a cesspool of Jew hatred. 95% of them hate Jews. They're the most supportive of suicide bombing of any Muslim territory or country. They would vote Hamas into power again if they ever were allowed to vote again. They worship Hamas, even though Hamas got half of Gaza destroyed and for nothing. But the gains that they've made are not on the battlefield, these savages. The gains are by making Israel look bad in the world forum, I suppose, in the eyes of the world. Because Israel dares to defend itself and the world, which is filled with, you know, an amazing number of Jew haters, just fall right in line with it and say, oh, well, we're going to believe everything that Hamas tells us. The Israelis blew up a hospital. Oh, they did it. You know, Hamas is telling the truth, and they find out that Hamas lied. Oh, Israel killed all those people at the stampede with the aid trucks. That's what Hamas says. That's a lie. They lie about everything. Israel's killing people in the hospital. Another lie. But for some reason, a lot of people in the West want to believe it, even if they don't really believe it. And the reason why Joe Biden flipped the script so much is because the Muslim radicals in America have been very potent. Not only do they commit terror every chance they get, they're having these ridiculously offensive marches and riots. They're spitting on Jews in colleges and attacking them. It's got nothing to do with Israel. It's got one thing only. It's because they're Jewish. But they're saying if you don't, not only are we going to make you miserable, we're going to interrupt you, we're going to attack you, we're going to fight you, but we're not going to vote for you. And that's all Joe Biden cares about. He'll change foreign policy to assuage the Muslim terror bloc. It's astonishing to me. And Hamas isn't stupid. I have great respect for their evil and their ruthlessness. It's astonishing to me how humans can be this purely evil. They refuse to surrender. They refuse to return the hostages. They know that the more civilians that Israel kills in Gaza. And keep in mind that it's Hamas who reports the so-called death totals of the so-called civilians. So as I said, you know they're lying. But they know that the more civilians that are killed by Israel in Gaza, the more pressure on Biden to stop Israel in the world, and the more Israel looks bad. So why should they make a ceasefire deal? Why would they, when they know that they can get more civilians killed by refusing, and then that hurts Israel more? But what are they know that Israel will be forced to go into Rafah, which is the last stronghold for Hamas. They'll be forced to go into Rafah and slaughter all of the Hamas that they can find that are hiding among civilians. This is why they don't want the ceasefire. But as I said, they've had plenty of time to hide among the civilians. They've had plenty of time to get their families and the top leaders into Egypt with the help of the backstabbing Egyptian government. They know Israel will be killing civilian human shields in Rafah. Their position is, we don't give a fuck if you kill these people. They're worthless to us. They've told us already, Hamas, that they don't care about their own civilians. They look at it like it's just going to hurt Israel more if they're forced to go into Rafah and continue fighting us. And as I said on October 9th, my first podcast after the massacre, Hamas has one military tactic, getting civilians killed so the world condemns Israel and stops them. But this strategy doesn't work unless you have useful idiots to go along with it. And that's what Joe Biden is. He's following Hamas's strategy now to the fullest, which is astonishing to me. He's blaming Israel for civilian deaths in Gaza and demanding they give more aid to these people, which is then promptly stolen by Hamas. So Israel is feeding the enemy. Biden knows that he needs to placate the Muslim terror vote. So he's got to say these things and do these things. And it's amazing to me that the guy is, Biden, is so evil and so ambitious and so greedy that he has to win this election. He doesn't care if it harms the world. the reason that Hamas is giving to not agree to a ceasefire, and they're going to just keep upping the requests. They're asking for every mass murderer that's in an Israeli prison. So obviously Israel's finally figured out that that's not a good idea. But they're going to keep upping what they want, their demands, because they want there to not be a ceasefire. The reason that they're holding it back now is they refuse to release the elderly hostages, the sick hostages, the wounded ones. They refuse to provide the names of the hostages who were still alive. I mean, how utterly depraved is this? Is there a peep from the world at how depraved this is? Does this sound like people that want a ceasefire? You need to protect Gazans. Oh, but we're not going to stop the war for 6 weeks by simply turning over people that were shot or wounded. So fucking evil, these people are. They're just fully diseased. But for some reason, there's barely any criticism of Hamas for refusing the ceasefire because of those terms. All, you know, we hear from their supporters that there's a genocide in Gaza and the poor Palestinians, but all they have to do to get a ceasefire is turn over just the sick people and the elderly, and they won't do it. As if we should be kissing their asses anyway. This is why, like at every pro-Palestinian rally across the globe, they're never asking for the hostages to be released or for Hamas to surrender. They're part of the same propaganda war against Israel. Pretend there's a genocide. Pretend we care about Palestinian civilians. But all we really want is a ceasefire to save Hamas. Nobody gives a shit about the regular people in Gaza. They don't even care about themselves. When Biden says we must get a ceasefire before the holy month of Ramadan is like comical. He knows full well that Palestinians go fucking apeshit during Ramadan with their terror attacks in the West Bank, even more than the rest of the year. The Palestinians are saying, how dare you attack us on our holy month of Ramadan? Well, the Yom Kippur War was started by the Arabs in the area on the holiest day of the year for Israel. October 7th, that massacre was during an Israeli Jewish holiday. They don't give a fuck about their religious month. And even if they did, it's like they can attack Israel during Jewish holidays, but how dare you even consider? And that's what Biden is doing. He's again falling into their trap. He's not even falling into the trap. He's knowingly doing it. He's taking their position to placate the savages in his own fucking party. He gives a shit about Ramadan. He's pretending like they're human and they would never dare to commit a terror attack during their holy month. Meanwhile, if there's ever a ceasefire reached, everybody in the West Bank, all the terrorists in the West Bank are still going to go nuts. It's not going to end. What they do at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, their third holiest place in Islam, meanwhile they store rocks in there and Molotov cocktails and bombs, they don't give a shit about that space. It's jihad is all that matters. Jihad. Jihad. They don't care about their holy mosque. And Hamas knows that if they don't commit to a ceasefire, that Ramadan will bring more violence in the West Bank. It will bring perhaps violence from the Arabs that live inside Israel. Why? Because they know that Israel is going to have to respond to the terrorism in the West Bank, and it's going to end up with more dead Palestinians. I mean, they're going to have to try to protect themselves, and by doing so, they're going to be killing Palestinians, and they're hoping that will trigger more violence in the West Bank, more violence inside Israel. And it'll provide relief to them in Gaza because Israel will be required to split up some of their forces and put some there. And more importantly, it'll isolate Israel more because the world is not falling. Again, they're knowingly going along with Hamas by castigating Israel every time a Palestinian civilian slash willing human shield is killed. You know, you're not a savage, dear listener, so you can't even believe that these people are like this, but they are. It's just about jihad. To end this strategy of Hamas, all Biden has to say is, you killed Americans, you hold Americans hostage. If you don't surrender in 24 hours and give back the hostages, we will supply Israel with all that it needs to finish you off. And if you hide behind civilians, you are responsible for their deaths. That's all Joe Biden has to say. He says that, and it takes away all the power of Hamas, and this ends quickly. Israel is then unleashed. Not only does Hamas get destroyed, but it sends one hell of a message to Hezbollah in Lebanon, because Hezbollah is looking at this and saying, we can massacre Israelis too, and Joe Biden will protect us the way he's protecting Hamas. The Houthis, the mullahs in Iran, This war in Gaza would be over in days if we had a tough president, but instead he plays right into their strategy. It's just stunning to me that he's doing this. And as I try to say, do you think this ends with just this war ending with the Muslim terror bloc in America, with all the violence on campus, all the violence in our streets from them, all the threats? You can't, an Israeli professor can't give a speech in a university. He gets attacked. He gets spit on. You know, you can't walk around New York City. If anybody thinks you're Jewish, they're going to attack you. You think this ends when Israel pulls out of Gaza? No, 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 no. You're giving them, you're appeasing. So now they want something more. They see they can get away with what they did. So why stop at just Israel being removed from Gaza? Well, they can demand other things from the government. And the Democrats are, you know, all too willing to give shit to them. The fact that we're even negotiating, the fact that Hamas is even allowed to negotiate, they should be absolutely fucking slaughtered, every one of them. And whoever is hiding, is in front of them, letting them hide, kill them too. It's the only thing that's going to stop this spread of the disease of radical Islam. But instead, you got Biden ripping Israel every day due to the dead civilians in Gaza. But he says nothing about the Israelis, civilians getting killed in the north from rockets from Hezbollah. I guess Israel just has to live with it, according to Joe Biden. What would happen if Canada launched rockets into Buffalo? You know, Canada would disappear. It would be obliterated. But for some reason, Hezbollah rockets, not a problem. The Houthis, yet another Iranian terror proxy. They destroyed a cargo ship in the Red Sea the other day. They killed two Filipinos and one Vietnamese, critically wounding others. I mean, these were civilians just doing their job. Joe Biden, in response, shot down some drones. I mean, who gives a fuck about this? Why didn't he talk about those civilians that were killed? Because they don't have Muslim terrorists advocating for them going crazy in America, threatening not to vote for them. He certainly doesn't shut up about Gaza civilians who die and they hate our guts. Why does he never speak about the American citizens who died on October 7 or who were held hostage now? Why do we only have to hear about the Gazan maniacs who support Hamas, many of whom helped in the massacre on October 7? Again, one reason he doesn't want to lose the Muslim terror vote in Michigan. It's insane, but it's really irrefutably true. And everything in the Middle East that is going wrong can be traced back to one source, Iran. And I hate to beat a fucking dead horse, but not only are they killing Israelis with Hamas and Hezbollah, but the Houthis are killing people now. They're destroying trade ships, cargo ships. They're destroying trade routes in the Red Sea, and they're costing all of us money. Inflation, because the price of moving goods to America through that Red Sea area is going up. These are all Iranian proxies, and other Iranian militias are attacking and killing Americans in the Middle East and in Syria and Jordan and Iraq. Joe Biden's response to this is to unfreeze billions of dollars for Iran, which they use for terror purposes to kill Americans and Israelis. I mean, how can this be? How is there not a coalition of the willing of nations in the West banding together to take out the mullahs that rule Iran? They're also slaughtering their own people. They're trying to kill Americans here. They're killing Americans over there. And Joe Biden ignores it. He doesn't have any negative words for Iran compared to Israel. He tells that Pete Buttigieg and Tony Blinken, that capo Jew, I'm going to have a come to Jesus moment with Bibi. First of all, fuck you. Come to Jesus moment? Fuck you. Fuck you. Come to Jesus. How won't you have a come to Jesus moment with Rashida Tlaib, who shits all over you? She openly supports Hamas. Why don't you have a come to Jesus moment with the head of Hamas? And why don't you send some special forces in there to remove his head? Why don't you do something other than harming America? We're dropping off aid to these people? They hate our guts. The West should be banding together to take out the Iranian terror leadership, which, as I said, not only slaughters its own people, but is slaughtering us as well, causing mayhem all over the world. Think what would happen to their terror proxies. They'd all shrivel and dry up. Israel should be unleashed as a weapon of America, not held back. And look, I hate Donald Trump, but guess what? None of this Iranian terror proxy shit happens with him in office, and Iran knows it. They have a leftist bag of cowardly shit in Joe Biden, and they know full well that he's afraid of his own shadow. Look how the Middle East is burning. Look how America is being overrun by Muslim terror and illegal criminals who are being led into the country, open borders, destroying young people, killing that poor woman in Georgia, the college student. Come on, this is happening all over America. This is a bipartisan issue. We can never agree on anything, the two sides, Democrats and Republicans. But the Democrats, at least the moderate ones, they want to live safely in their towns, their cities, in their homes. They know it's not going to happen with Joe Biden winning in November, assuming he's still alive. And as I said, it's purposeful what he's doing. It's Biden's plan to get illegals in here in record numbers in order to get more votes for Democrats in the future. He flew in hundreds of thousands of them from across the border because he didn't tell us. It was hidden until it was found out secretly. He said, oh, it's got to lower the crowding at the border. Who gives a fuck about the overcrowd? Let Mexico deal with it. Are they not a sovereign country? It's their border too. We give them aid. We help them. Pick up the phone. Call that criminal that runs Mexico and say, listen, we're not going to do shit for you if you don't start policing the border. He's not just allowing the invasion, Joe Biden. He's part of it. As I said, the parties differ on so much, and we never can find common ground, but the great majority of Americans want safety for their families, and that can only be achieved by closing the borders, being tough on the criminals that are in America instead of being ridiculous like they are in New York, and stopping Iranian-backed terror. All of that has skyrocketed under Biden, and all of that was down under Trump. You can hate him like I do. For ample reasons, because he will be a shitty president in many ways, like he was last time. But guess what? He's 1,000 times better than Joe Biden. Joe Biden is burning this country down. You'd have to be suicidal, not only for yourself, but for your country, to vote for Joe Biden in November. And convince me otherwise, because you can't. Jeffrey Lichtman for Beyond the Legal Limit. You can find me on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio. You know where to find me. See you next week.